Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 1, delivered on January 11, 2011. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. Finance is sometimes cast, and certainly in this book, it is cast that way, as a cross between accounting and economics. That in some ways is accurate, but it misrepresents finance as being something like a bastard child, which it is most decidedly not. It is a fully formed field of its own. We use accounting information, but for God's sake, we are not accountants. I would rather die than be an accountant. Not to offend accountants, because they are truly noble creatures. And they should be kept for future generations to see and appreciate. But you see, we are much more dedicated to economic thinking. We use the numbers of accounting, but we recognize the vast limits, and that is nothing against accounting. Accounting must abide rules that represent, that reflect essentially evidence of, perhaps even provability of, the representations. Necessarily, then, accounting, for the most part, provides historical information. And that is where the real problem comes in. The world is not about history. The world is about expectations of the future as far as finance goes. It does not matter what the historical record indicates. You can't tell what a stock is going to do tomorrow by looking at the stock price for the last 10 years day by day. It doesn't work that way. That information is already impounded in the current stock price. You can't get any more information out of the past because it has already been extracted. It is even worse than that now in finance. There are places now where it's not just the past that is already reflected in the price, it's the actual future that's reflected in the price. A few microseconds into the future, there are some very powerful programs now being used that are taking a peek, a couple of just a very short time into the future, and they're able to react to what is going to happen. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the course. Know this. In economics, cost means something substantially but subtly different from what it means in accounting terms. We are certainly interested, wildly interested in costs in account in finance, and we can certainly get information about cost from accounting statements. But you see, most of the time, the largest cost involved in any undertaking is not a cost that is seen. We call it in economics opportunity cost. It is the cost of the best foregone alternative. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. Now, here's what that means. You are a cheeseburger lover. You can has cheeseburger, as they say at the Lolcats. But you'll have to drive an hour to get to the cheeseburger you love. Well, the cheeseburgers are on sale for $2. You make at your job $10, in your case, okay, $8 an hour. So that cheeseburger doesn't cost you $2, it costs you $10. You see, because you gave up. You say, well, I wasn't working. But you could have been. It is what you could have earned in your highest and best use. Now, some of you are townies here, and some of you are from out of town. But let me give you the example of the grocery stores in town. There are some grocery stores that offer low, low prices, and then there are grocery stores that offer very high prices for just about the same thing. Why would any rational person pay a high price at Schnucks when you could get the same thing at Walmart at a much lower price? Well, let's go through the exercise. And I speak from experience being a Walmart shopper. First, you have to find a parking place at Walmart, usually in another county. And then you have to walk clear through the parking lot, nearly get picked off by some fool in a truck that says, my wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never. Then you walk in and you get someone, you hear a voice, hi, and you look out, ah, they're hiring dwarfs as greeters now. You walk down the aisles and there is some very large person, honey, I'm on the phone here at the Walmart, what did you want for dinner? Get out of my way, cow. And then when you finally get your stuff, you stand in a line for 30 minutes. Sure enough, right in front of you are snot-nosed kids. One of them's got his finger in his nose looking at you. And the old lady up at the front of the line, she's learning how to use a debit card. Well, that was the 13th time. It still isn't working. Maybe I got change. Hurry up, Granny. You're going to die. Eat. Go home. 30 minutes. Okay, I saved $5 at Walmart. But if you are making $10 an hour, how much did you pay to stand in that line?
The $10 plus the groceries you bought.
But it was 30 minutes, so it'd be $5. But you're right. So you see, if I go to Schnucks, where the prices are high and only the people in town who have their noses up so high they can't smell their own farts are in line, then I won't spend hardly any time in line. I never do. So my opportunity cost of time is lower there. That will drive decision making. It will drive decision making. Far more than the prices in some cases. You know what? This is a cheap education you get here. It really is a cheap education. Your tuition isn't that bad. I mean, at least it isn't that stuff over that snooty private school in town. Not that I would mention Illinois West. Sorry. I get my ass kicked all the time. People listen to this podcast. I make jokes about Decatur. I'm sorry about that. And then people, my mom's from Decatur. Yes, I know she is, son. Met her at the truck stop. But look, think about how much you're really paying here. Well, what's full-time tuition here now? What is it about? God! You're paying that for my ass? Oh, sorry. Yeah. How much? A grand? Yeah, 10 grand. Yeah, 10 grand. That was more what I was saying, you know. But you see, look at all the time. This course, you're going to spend Oh, about 3.5, let's say 4 hours a week in the classroom. Well, let's do 3 hours in the classroom every week, okay? For every hour you're in this classroom, to get a decent grade, you should be spending 2 to 3 hours studying. You're saying, yeah, okay? So let's take a 16-week semester. Not just 3 hours, but 3 hours plus 6 hours. That's 9 hours. 16 times 9. What the hell is 16 times 9? 144 hours? Let's tack on a couple of hours to study for the final. 146. Let's tack on the maybe about, let's say, 4 hours walking to and from classes on these beautiful, bitter cold days in the Midwest where the wind doesn't blow. The wind sucks. And you think about 150 hours and $10 an hour, your opportunity cost right there, there's another $1,500 right there just in opportunity cost alone. You see, that's one of the things about opportunity cost is it hides. I'll give you some great examples in the business world where the fallacy of opportunity cost avoidance. Well, we've already got the land, so we don't have to pay for land for this project, so that's not a cost of the project. Yes, it is, because that land could have been used for something else. You could have rented it, you could have sold it. The opportunity cost of using it for this project must be a real recognized cost of the project. And oftentimes it's not. When I take you off one job to do another project, you are an opportunity cost. Because no, I don't. It's not that I already have you as an employee. I have lost your productivity in another place. You have a car. Do you have a car? Oh, I think I saw you. It's an ugly thing. Yeah, oh yeah, okay. Now you're imagining to yourself, okay, well, this car is precious to me. And we'll sell it. Okay, I'm going to keep it. Okay, you know what? Suppose it's suddenly on eBay, your particular model of Camry suddenly went to $150,000 on the bid. Now, how much is that car going to cost you to keep? $150,000. Because if the opportunity costs of you, every day that you don't give up that beautiful car of yours, you are giving up money, real money. So opportunity cost is a driving force in decision making, something that I will bring up over and over and over again. And it's not something you can find in the accounting data. That's not because accounting is wrong. It's just that that's something that you can't represent by generally accepted accounting principles consistently applied. You just can't. But it is still there as a powerful force. Have any of you ever been to a theme park? Well, hell yes. Have you ever seen the lines waiting for those damn rides? You know what? Rich people don't do that. Down at Disney, you can actually pay a big amount of money and cut to the front of the lines of the rides. Because if you're wealthy, the opportunity cost of your time is higher. Years ago, back in the 1990s, one of my daughters, this was the time when those idiotic boy bands were around. I can't remember what the name of the one that was real popular then. Hanson. Yeah, and Hanson was in town. My daughter wanted to go, so I thought, okay, I'll buy her tickets. Buy her a ticket or a friend a ticket. Well, the line for the tickets for the show, when I drove into town, there the line was starting at the edge of town, almost literally. A veritable legion of shrieking, squeaking teeny boppers. Dads were just dropping their daughters off. Bye, don't get bothered by old man. I wasn't going to stand in that line. I didn't want to die there, become old. But you see, those kids would, because what was the opportunity cost of their time? Very low. But if you're older, you've got a great job, when you're working at State Barn for $50,000 a year, standing in that line for 6 hours, oh, FTS. Fancy that scenario. You understand how powerful these concepts are once you begin to think about every decision you make is driven by costs that come out of your pocket, but the most vicious of the costs is the cost that is not seen. It can be the dominant, overwhelming cost, and it drives our decision making. Here's another one that's a danger, is sunk cost. Sunk cost. The sunk cost fallacy is the fallacy that money you've already spent has anything to do whatsoever with current and future investment decisions. The fallacy that a cost already incurred, money already spent, has anything whatsoever to do with current and future investment decisions. God, I saw this when I was a business consultant. We already spent $2 million on this, so we've got to keep going. Think about it this way, and this comes from my investment time. You bought shares of stock in a corporation. You spent $100 a year ago. Well, today that stock is worth $10. The portfolio is worth $10. Now, you will say, I'll say, okay, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to keep that stock until it goes back to $100. I'm going to keep it until I recover my money. And therein lies the death of logic. You know where that $100 is? It's at home with Jesus. It died. That $100 has wings, it's gone. There is no $100. There is none. The only thing you have is $10. And your investment decision, buy, hold, sell, is based upon the future of that $10. Not on the $100. The $100 is not there anywhere. You would swear it is. It is not. Well, I just put $1,000 worth of brakes on this car, so I gotta get $1,000 for it when I sell it. No, you don't. You don't gotta get nothing. What that car is worth is what it's worth, not what you put into it yesterday, the day before yesterday, 10 years ago. It's worth what it's worth based upon the supply and demand of the market now, and the expectations for the future. Now, these are the kinds of things that in a class like this I bitch and bitch and bitch at you about, because this is how we shape your thinking, how I will get you to the point where you can go out there and not fall into traps and fallacies and not miss huge costs that could blindside you in your work in whatever field you go into. Now, by the way, if you are a finance major or if you're thinking of becoming a finance major, talk to me. I will turn you to the dark side. The Financial Management Association, the FMA here, has its own Facebook page I created. Look for Illinois State University Financial Management Association. We have meetings. We have pizza. We have guests, and we do accept applications even from accountants. But when you come into our world, into finance, we see the world in a harsh light. You see, markets are brutally rational. The idea that was stated in 1995 by former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan. He said, the stock market is showing irrational exuberance. The stupid, dumb ass. No we are not irrational. Yes, billions and billions of transactions, trillions and trillions of dollars hammered by people all over the world desperately trying to find profit by selling and buying. Yeah, as a group, over a period of time, they're all going to be crazies. Sure, Alan. That's what drives me to the point where I almost become a Satan worshiper when I hear this word bubble. There was a bubble in the stock market. There was a bubble in the real estate market. What does that mean? Some complete irrational thought turned them into a bunch of loopies. Well, we're either going to drive the stock, we're either going to drive real estate prices up, or we're going to shoot someone in the head. One way or the other, we're crazies. No, markets are not irrational. They are driven by greed, by information, and by a lack of sentimentality. So in this course, that's why I told you, remember I told you at the beginning, when you answer a question, don't ever say, I believe or I feel. Because we are not about beliefs and feelings. We're about animal drive to get the right answer. Because if we get it wrong, there's going to be some son of a bitch out there who's going to plow us under. And when we get projects wrong, God, the consequences can be disastrous. Legion is the name of the financial geniuses who had great ideas for projects that turned into absolute disasters. Oftentimes because they just didn't think about the basics. Opportunity cost, sunk cost, and all of those kinds of things. Look, in finance, we do a lot of accounting, take accounting data. A lot of times in that regard, what we're looking for is really not so much tea leaves about what the future holds as we are, especially at the corporate level, when we're doing fundamental analysis, technical analysis, we're looking for what the corporate management's black box is thinking. Oh, well, they're moving toward more debt and less equity. Oh, look at this. One that was just amazing to me, and I'll give you real financial statements. Sometimes I'll give you kind of phony ones with easy numbers that come out, but a lot of times I'll give you real ones. Last semester I used Amazon.com. There was something fascinating that happened. It was a very low debt corporation for a long time. And I went through and I did the financial ratios looking for debts expected to be zero, and I got it wrong at first. Because I had forgotten to notice that intermediate term debt is something that could be used too. Sure enough, there was Amazon.com, and I could see a window on the management thinking. Oh, well, we really want to stay low debt, but we need money to finance expansion, so we're going to go to intermediate term debt. And in that way, as you look into the nuance of those statements, you begin to see what's going on in the minds of the financial managers within a corporation. Now, finance can be divided into three kind of distinct fields, but they really are interrelated. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. But the three basic fields and sub-disciplines in finance, or career paths, if you will, are financial management. When you work inside of a company and you crunch the numbers to see what projects are good, how to finance, what the costs are going to be. The book gives you a nice little compact explanation or definition of financial management. But that's in a nutshell what it's about. Now, the second sort of branch of finance is institutions. Markets and institutions, where you would work for one of the intermediaries or for, in some way, for one of the places where money flows through. And then the third aspect is investments, where you are looking for adding value, for profitability from investing in corporations or in other projects, bonds, stocks. One thing that kind of bothers me, and I'll share this with you, it's off the record, so if you tell anyone, I'll kill you. But you know, a lot of times in finance, when I bring people in to talk, I end up bringing in people who talk about sales jobs in finance. Yeah, the world is driven by sales, and a lot of you will unfortunately live at least part of your life doing sales. I hate that. It's grim. But, you know, finance is a lot more than just selling something to someone. It's a lot about analysis and thinking in ways that are disciplined, but at the same time, recognizing that what you're doing actually is important, because whether you are doing investments and helping people plan for their future, or analyzing from the inside of a corporation, trying to figure out whether a project is a go or a no-go, or working in a bank, trying to set up a working capital account for a small or medium-sized business. In these regards, we, as well as any other aspect of business, we are adding value to an economy. And that value that we add is strengthened greatly by how accurately we do our work. In this course, whenever you give me an answer, I want it to 2 decimal places. Don't give me any more, don't give me any less. I cut you slack 1/100th of a decimal place off. So when you give me an answer that's supposed to be reported as a percentage, you would say, for example, 28.53%. Don't give me strings of numbers. Don't say 29%. 28.3%, and get it right, because one small slip of a decimal can literally mean millions of dollars. In our world today, it's funny, because when I first started in business, it was almost head spinning, the idea of $1 billion. Now I throw numbers around in analysis in the hundreds of billions in some cases. It's just how large the economies of the world, the business activity of the world has become, that we have to get it right. So if it seems like I'm being a bitch about the number of decimal places and the accuracy, that's just because we have to do it really well anymore. And if we don't do it well, someone else is going to do it well, or someone's going to suffer for sure. So remember that. I won't say it again, but if you don't give me the 2 decimal place rule, unless I specify differently, then you'll have your feelings hurt when you get your paper back. Now, in finance, like I said, this course focuses on financial management. However, the other fields have huge impact, even in financial management. For example, I am excitedly interested in what the Federal Reserve is going to do, because it drives the short-term interest rate environment. And so when interest rates are changed, that changes the investment landscape. Think about it this way, and you'll have to write these numbers down. Project A is expected to return 15%. Project B is expected to return 9% on investment. And Project C is expected to return 5% on investment. Now, if the prevailing interest rate environment is such that the cost of borrowing for projects is 3%, do you see that all three of those projects, A, B, and C, will be attractive and accepted? Are you okay with that? It's obvious. But if the interest rate environment rises so that a risk-adjusted interest rate prevailing for borrowing capital is 7%, I will no longer take Project C. The rising interest rate environment is altering not just what I decide to accept, but essentially, fundamentally, slowing down the business investment environment. If interest rates rise to 12%, then I throw out B and C. So notice, first of all, that as interest rates rise, I, as an internal manager, financial analyst, deciding projects up or down, must alter my up and down signals. But there's something darker going on here too. You see, risk and return are related. If I want a higher expected return, I have to take on more risk. That's just the nature of the universe. And I'll come back to that in a minute, but this is where I sneak in one of the most important concepts in finance. If you want a higher return, you have to take a higher risk. Do you see what's happening to this company of mine as the interest rate environment drives me away from 5% C and 9% B? What's left of my corporation is a project that will yield an expected return of 15%. The riskiest of my projects. I am being flogged into the corner of the Hail Mary Pass because the interest rate environment, the macro interest rate environment that I can't control because it's controlled by people in Washington, is suddenly making me back into a corner where all I've got in my portfolio is the riskiest thing that was available to me. A 15% Hail Mary pass, which guarantees that I'm probably going to get my ass kicked. And that creates a downward spiral, you see, because the businesses, as the interest rates go up, businesses are dropping the lower end projects. Unemployment goes up for that. Business investment's going down. But then, as these companies backed into the corner are taking only their most the riskiest projects, the companies have a higher probability of failing, and that adds to the disaster at the macroeconomic level. So I sit there as a financial manager in my sad little cubicle, being a component of something that is much larger, that can be quite dark. Now let me go back to expected return and risk. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. That is one of the most fundamental principles of finance. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. Rationally speaking, you are not going to bear great risk unless you expect great return. That doesn't mean you're going to get great return. It's all about expectations. In the world of finance, we can't see the future. We can only expect it using our best, strongest, most disciplined judgment. But in that regard, if you want more money, if you expect a better return, you have got to take on more risk. And you won't take on more risk unless you expect a better return, notwithstanding movies like Jackass. But it's interesting about that, you see, because we see people take risk, and it seems like they're being irrational. Well, what's the return? What are they expecting out of this? It's not always money. Sometimes it's status. God knows, I've seen people who weren't going to get much out of it, except everyone says, dude, when they did something stupid, or they get their face on failblog.org. But you see, in finance, you're not going to take on more risk unless you expect something for it. You're just not going to do it. Now, what constitutes your risk preference is different for different people. Most of you actually are fairly risk averse, and you will become more so as you get older. But there are some people who are, I don't know, how many of you actually know someone who's just a crazy mofo? Yeah. I mean, I do not, you know, I believe it, but I mean, I've had people like that. You know, you're just crazy. Are you out of your mind? We're going 180 outrunning a Florida highway patrolman. Are you crazy? Oh, that's right, you are. He actually did it too. Well, what did you get out of it? I got to see you shit your pants, man. No, but you see, and interestingly enough, though, you see, most of us want to avoid risk as much as possible, but we also still want to get a decent return. So what we have to do is find the most efficient way to get to that expected return, minimizing the risk we have to bear. Interestingly enough, one of the most powerful places in finance is the markets where risk is bought and sold. Risk. So that a company that doesn't want to bear a certain kind of risk can actually pay another company to absorb, to wear that risk. All of you are doing that right now if you have insurance. An insurance company will take risk of yours if you pay them to. Auto insurance, life insurance, health insurance. They are in the business of risk. You, in most businesses, we're not in the business of risk. So, for example, if I run a trucking operation, my risk I want is the business risk of the ups and downs of shipping and delivering merchandise over the road. I don't want to bear the risk of fuel prices going up and down. When fuel prices go down, well, great, my profits go up. But if fuel prices go up, my profits go down. Why would I want to do that kind of risk? That's not my core business model. But I can actually slough off that risk in futures markets. By taking opposite positions in futures, there are people out there, financial institutions out there, that'll take the opposite side of the market so that if gasoline prices go up, I would win. If gasoline prices go down, I would lose as a trucker, as a trucking line operator. But ultimately, that wipes out for me the risk of fuel prices. And all that's left is my profit and loss that comes from being a truck line operator. So that's what one of the most powerful markets out there. It's a very cool market. It's a much misunderstood market, much maligned market by idiots. Oh, it's these future speculators. No. They are so fundamental because they get risk off companies that the companies don't want and shouldn't have. So the companies can focus on the risks that are the risks of their core business model. Now let me emphasize this though, that again, the greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. I will emphasize later in the course that risk is not just one risk. There are two fundamentally different kinds of risk. There is, and I'm going to use bad terminology here, but there is stupid risk, and then there is unavoidable risk. Stupid risk we call diversifiable or non-systematic risk. No one's going to reward you for taking stupid risk that you didn't have to take. You should expect a reward only for the risk that is systemic, that is non-diversifiable, that is unavoidable. That is the risk for which you should expect a return. The truth of the matter is that any given single stock, its price volatility is overwhelmingly non-systematic risk. You will not get rewarded for it. You are a fool to buy a single stock because that stock has a whole hell of a lot of risk that wouldn't be there if you had that stock in a diversified portfolio. That volatility would be canceled out by all the other. Underneath all of those stocks and their individual volatilities, there is a hum of risk. That's what you should expect to be rewarded for, but not just the risk of an individual security. You're crazy to do that kind of stuff. Trust me. And on a related note, if you ever watch financial news networks or some of these read financial papers or read magazines, they'll talk about the highest performing money manager this year was Studley Von Goodloin here. He had a return on his money market mutual fund of 83%. Ha ha ha. Isn't that wonderful? Do you know how stupid that is? What was the risk that he took to do that? You got some manager over here, well, I made a 12% return. Geez, that kind of sucked, didn't it? Yeah, you didn't take risk. He took risk. Good for him. Give him a cookie, pat him on the fanny. You see, you will get that higher expected return only if you're taking massive risk. Now, I want you to think about it. Someday you're going to be old. You're going to be spending most of your time shopping online for Viagra. Okay. You're going to have an enlarged prostate. Dogs won't even look at you unless you hang a pork chop around your neck. And then they will be nice to you, friendly. Now, you've got your money, and I'm a young hotshot money manager, salesman. Well, I'd like to get you into some stocks and bonds that have been yielding for the last couple of years 150% returns on investment. Is that your kind of thing? What are you, about 70 years old? You got a couple of years to live yet. Don't you want to put your money in these investments of mine? Do you?
No.
Oh, hell no. I mean, you could end up your last years not just eating dog food, you could be dog food. Do you understand that just bragging because you got a high return on your investment means nothing? What risk did you take to get that? That's where you have to look, is not just return, but risk taken to get that return. Do you really want to make the kind of money that the hot shots do? I did. You know what I found out? That's a really dangerous world. Sort of like Pulp Fiction, except it's not funny. You see, so I decided, well, I don't want to do that because, you know, it's like getting shot in the ass and people playing with guns and pointing them at each other. And where did this money come from for this investment? Well, it came from, no, don't tell me, for God's sake, please, please. You know, yeah, you can make lots of money and take lots of risk. Or you can do things smart and not make so much money and not take so much risk. Everyone has to make the choice. But if you think that someone's a hero just because of a high return, you're thinking wrong. You're not thinking like finance people do. Now here's the last point of this lecture, is something crucial. Let me try this on you. I've been picking on one side of the room. Let me go to the other side of the room. You, sir. I can give you $100 now, or I can give you $100 in a year. You decide.
No.
You greedy son of a bitch. Oh, yeah, because you see, there's, you know, he's not going to have the joy of that $100 for a year if he takes it in a year. If you get the $100 now, you could actually, you know, like buy a friend on Craigslist. Well, that was harsh. We're going to do Tiger Woods. That was mean. But you see, here's the thing. Now is preferred to later. You think, okay, well, unless it's pain, you know, pain I'll put off for a while. But, you know, we're talking about good things. Now is preferred to later. More is preferred to less. Better is preferred to crappier. Funny how that works in the world, but in finance, it's even more important. You see, because, you know, you hear these words like profit. Profit is really not that important in finance. What matters is cash flow. You see, you could be a very wealthy person, be profitable, but if you don't have the money to pay your light bill, you're going to hear someone say, "Hello, who turned off the lights?" Cash flow is what really matters in finance far more than profit. That's why in the I praise the book for this. The book in the first chapter points out it's not profit, it's value. Value is what we are after in our business lives. Even in our personal lives, it's value. A lot of you are going to make choices that increase your understanding of the value of your life far more than you will be driven by just the highest paying job you can possibly get. Really, that's one of the things that I've noticed as a change from the young people I would have taught in the 80s and the 90s. And even in the early part of this century, now people are saying, well, yeah, I'm shocked. People say, I wouldn't mind working for the government, to do good, or for a nonprofit for a while. You see, that value, that sense that there's something beyond just the profit of the day. Far too many firms burned very brightly for a very short time because they were driven by today and the profits of today, and they were not building shareholder value. And also building a value in the company that goes beyond just the shareholders. It has to do with a value. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not some liberal. But I'm talking to you as a rational, old-time conservative, not one of you crazy-ass mofos now. But the old-time line was, we build value, and part of value is this strength we have in all of the people who work here, who know all of this stuff about our company, who are the history of the company and their living work, their productivity. We build value in the customer trust in us, in the name we have. And if we make a mistake, my God, we first and foremost say, we're sorry, we screwed up. Not have some song and dance about how it wasn't really our fault. You see, that's what creates fundamental, strong value. Cash flow is part of that. Not what gets us the highest number at the bottom line at net income, but what keeps us going. Not just today, but in the future. Now, cash flow has three pieces, three components, three dimensions. First is the level of the cash flow, the size of it. The first of the three dimensions of cash flow is the level, the size of the cash flow. I can give you a dollar or a thousand, madam. Which do you prefer?
A thousand.
Greedy woman. My God. Okay. The second is the timing of the cash flow. I can give you $1,000 today, or I can give you $1,000 in 20 years. Like you're going to be alive with the life you live. No. You try to see timing. You see? Money now, the same money now is worth more than money later. The same money. And we have actually an equation. It's like a unit. It's really a unit conversion. It's more complicated than centimeters to inches. But we can actually convert tomorrow money to today. It's just a unit conversion with a rather crazy formula. Fortunately, our calculators do that for us now. And then the third part is the risk of the cash flow. The risk of the cash flow. Now, think about it this way. Bill Gates comes up and to you. You, sir. Bill Gates comes up to you and says, "Hey, listen, I'd like to borrow $100. Well, you know.
What money do you pay?
He'll pay you back in a year. Now, I am some street person. Here you go, homie. I need $100. I'll give you $100 back in a year. I'll even write it on this napkin I blew my nose on, but I owe you $100. Here's the damn note. Which of those is a riskier investment? Yeah. You see, that doesn't mean you wouldn't lend. You'd probably lend me less than you would Bill Gates. You might lend Bill Gates $90 to get back $100. You might lend me $10 to get back $100. But you see, the three components are the size, the level, the timing, and the risk of the cash flow. So when you tell me that there's going to be $1,000, well, I need to know, first of all, well, it's $1,000, so the size. I want to know when and how likely it is that I'm actually going to see that money. And that will tell me how excited I should be about that. In this place here, you are taking on an extraordinary amount of risk. You are expecting a reward. Let me ask you, is anyone in here because you love finance and you've heard that I am the greatest professor that ever walked the earth? True as it might be. No, you're not in here for those reasons. You're in here because of an expectation. You are spending money now, expecting something later. What you are expecting has to be worth more later than the money you're spending on it now. That's just how it works. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.